Welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show, where we explore spiritual ideas and books that help you live a better life. Hosted by spiritual teacher and author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate, Jason Napolitano.
All right, hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have, as usual, on the line, my co-host, Chris Sheridan. What's up, Chris?
Well, everything's up. All good. Looking forward to this one today.
Everything's up, including the sky, is what's happening here. So today we are talking about the reconciliation of the opposites. So it's a pretty big topic. It's a broad topic. So I'm going to be occasionally looking down at my notes because I haven't transferred my notes to something on screen that I can look at. That's my fault. I apologize for that. But I want to stay on track because it is such a big subject, the opposites. You know, we could go all over the place. So I want to make sure we kind of stay in a little format so that we can share all the ideas that we want to. Thank you for listening. We're here every week on Sunday with a new show. And now we have our video, thanks to Chris and his push towards doing this. And I thank you for that, Chris. We're available on YouTube. I get those up on Monday or Tuesday, depending on when we get the video done. So the podcast goes up on Sunday, and then the video for that particular Sunday podcast goes up a day or two later. So those are available on the Cosmic Eye site. There's links to that on cosmiceye.org or on the anchor.fm/cosmiceye site. You can see the links in there. So reconciliation of the opposites. Oh, before we get into that, actually, thank you for everyone who supports the show. We really appreciate your financial support, and anyone who gets good value out of this show and wants to share with other people and see us reach out in a greater way, please do support the show. That is at anchor.fm/cosmiceye, and you can go to support the show. There's a button for that, and then you can make a monthly donation if you wish to do so. I'm going to be starting up a Patreon account soon as well. I don't know how to say that, Patreon or patron.
I have no idea.
Everyone knows it. I think it's Patreon.
I can't even spell it. So
I can't even spell it, let alone say it. But I'll have the information for that soon once we have it up. All right, let us get into this. So what are the opposites? Chris, since I've just been talking away, why don't you start with the frame the problem. What are the opposites and why do we need to reconcile? Actually, we won't even get into why we need to reconcile them, but what are the opposites? What's our issues here?
Okay, well, there are opposing forces. There are opposing principles. And I guess I can start out with saying like the Tao. There's the yin and the yang. You have male and female, dark and light, up and down, left and right, broken and solid, receptive and generative. They are really forces of nature. And the big one we have is night and day, which is kind of an example of how we look at opposites, because we even use that in our everyday language. Oh, they're as opposite as night and day. They're just completely different. But in a 24-hour cycle, which is every day, there are equal amounts of night and day. You can't have one without the other. So we use that as being diametrically opposed or mutually exclusive in the West especially. But in the East, with Taoism and Buddhism and more unity consciousness, a little more clear in Taoism, it's very specific with yin and yang.
Stop you. Let's get into that later.
Okay, sure.
Because that's going to be more in the solution portion of things. But let's frame the problem.
Well, the problem is that I think that the way the West and modernity, I guess, nowadays times, often looks at opposing ideas or opposing structures as being one versus the other, where one side doesn't see the other side. And that creates a host of problems. We have this two-party system in the American political arena. There are other parties, of course, but really like the two viable. And it's really set up with conflict. And in war and in sports, you know, generally it gets down to two teams and one has to win over the other. But war and sporting matches are kind of artificial things in society. They are constructs. What we need to see with ideas and everything else, is that they are not only connected, but they are in some ways two sides of the same coin. And instead of having a conflict against each other, look for the harmony that connects and the complementary nature instead of contradictory. That's, I think, the real problem with...
Okay. Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. And again, we're going to talk about that later on when we get into the solution area. But just framing the problem, I guess, is important, because I want people to kind of think about, you know, how this plays out in our daily lives, this problem of the opposites. And you made good points there, the two-party system and so on. I think some of the other sort of dichotomies that we struggle with today are, you know, the ideas of capitalism versus communism or socialism. You get the ideas of, you know, a sort of feminism versus the patriarchy. You get these very sort of polarized views. And then it seems that there's, like you said, a battle, which is an artificial construct in a lot of ways. So, you know, one of the challenges then with that is that we get stuck in one way or the other. It's an either or proposition, which leaves out a lot of varying degrees. And that's really the challenge with polarity or dichotomy or duality, in essence, is that it becomes a battle. Life then is a battle. And I think that's one of the main issues and the problems with this. And it's talked about a lot in your as well. But one of the main sort of ideological battles that goes on today is that between the scientific materialist worldview and what might be called a spiritual or religious worldview. Of course, science being interested in truth, quote unquote, discovering the hidden truths behind material existence, mostly concerning itself with technological advances, medicine, etc. But you know, it has become a worldview now that is sometimes often characterized as a scientism, so that it says, you know, there really is no ultimate value to life. There is only sort of this digging into this matter and investigating physical life to the utmost to discover its quote unquote the secrets of nature, but they're not really thought of as having meaning in the sort of scientific materialist worldview. And then so that the opposite side of that would be religion, which says of course that the world was created by a benevolent being or a non-benevolent being, whichever, you know, there's various interpretations in religious systems, but generally speaking, there's a sort of a spiritual cause to the material universe. Thus, there's sort of a meaning and an inherent structure to it, things that need and ought to be followed, rules, principles, archetypal sort of constructs upon which we should and ought to live our lives. So that's religion is concerned with meaning and value, whereas science is concerned with quote unquote truth. And that's truth with a capital, with a lower T, in a sense. It's like the sort of material truths, not to denigrate it, but it's not concerned with an ultimate truth because it doesn't even posit that there is one. So those are the two worldviews that smack up against each other. And actually, I want to read something really quick from this book, and I'm covering the name. It's Ken Wilber's Marriage of Sense and Soul, and he's got a great little quote concerning that. So he says, there's arguably no more important and pressing topic than the relation of science and religion in the modern world. Science is clearly one of the most profound methods that humans have yet devised for discovering truth, while religion remains the single greatest force for generating meaning. Truth and meaning, science and religion, but we still cannot figure out how to get the two of them together in a fashion that both find acceptable. And that is really the topic of this book in a nutshell. It's an excellent book, and it goes into many arguments in the history of modernism, postmodernism, scientific worldview, and so on, versus the sort of pre-modern, sort of archaic and mythological worldview of pre-modern man. So, all right, so framing the problem, we've talked about the problem. Let's talk about a little bit about the history. We're not going to get too deep in this, but a little bit of the history of how we got here. We talked a little bit about this before the show, in our sort of pregame that we do before the show. And I'll let you talk a little bit more in a second. I just want to frame this. So it's really difficult to tell when exactly this sort of idea arose in the human being, the idea of the sort of duality of life between, I mean, I'm sure people saw things, you know, as consciousness arose and we began to think or see or experience, you know, you see dichotomies between life and death. You notice the difference between male and female, and you see that there's somewhat opposites, seeming opposites in your viewpoint. You know, and you then, I think, as consciousness grows and ideas sort of morph, then you begin to have analogies and more abstract ideas that you kind of, you know, are able to extrapolate from those ideas and sort of project onto the outside world, as it were, you know, ideas of good, bad, ideas of positive and negative, us and them, you know, other groups, tribal groups, or, you know, culture groups. There's the in group and the out group. And then we begin to see, of course, the ideas of inside and outside and so forth. And all that is an outgrowth, I think, of observation, just as much sort of natural observation and consciousness that grows into, you know, more sophisticated and abstract worldviews, right? So do you have anything to add to that? I kind of wanted to just frame that sort of pre-modern sort of idea.
Right. Well, that is, it's a good way to frame it. And what you had said before about the big one from Willer between religion and science and religion, if we're looking at these external structures, you know, the scientific and the spiritual, there's also a corollary inside, because like science, you know, we all have a rational side, very seeing what's in front of us. And if this works, this makes me feel good, this doesn't. It's very scientific. So that's part of our psyche, as well as a more meaning-based. And so this conflict in the outer world between religious and scientific institutions is also going on inside of us too. So yes, we early on see, you know, me, not me, this I like, this I don't like, this berry will make me sick, this one won't. And you have to pass down that knowledge, because it's in our structure as a human. Really, most earth creatures need the contrast. Some animals can sense only motion, but it's motion against static, this difference. We need figure and ground. If it's in artwork or a sign you're painting, you don't want to put green letters on a green background. You won't be able to read it. There needs to be this contrast, what's me and what's not me in a picture frame. So that sets up, I think, really the seriousness with dealing this reconciliation of the opposites, because it's going on inside of us all the time, influenced.
That's a great point. That's a great point. You know, and one thing I want to add to that, when you're talking about that, speaking of Wilbur, he spoke about two different ways this occurs. One is in a way, a positive way, which he calls the sort of dignity of modernity, where there's a differentiation between these different spheres. There's a differentiation between religion and a differentiation between science that had not existed prior to the Enlightenment, right? But what has happened today is that there's a dissociation now between those two things. There's a difference between differentiation and dissociation. The differentiation implies that there's an integration possible, where a dissociation is something that has been completely dissociated or shoved into some corner or some shadow part of ourselves, to where we pretend it's not there anymore. We've almost cut it off as if it doesn't exist any longer. And that's dangerous. And that's where I think a lot of these challenges where science and religion are butting up against each other, and these different ideological stances, identity politics, and, you know, gender issues, and all these different battles we find butting up against each other, are in that sort of dissociated sort of mindset. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And that's a great word that you, a term that you've used, and thanks for clarifying it, to, you know, to disassociate. Is, you're right, it doesn't allow for...
Well, thank Ken.
Oh,
Wilbur.
Okay. Well, you brought it up, so thanks for for mentioning it. But it's, you know, differences are important. Differences are necessary. What's, you know, we talk a lot about comparative philosophy, comparative religion, and ideas and trying to find a single story within, you know, the monomyth within all the thousand myths. But the differences are important too, because they can lead us to different discoveries, even about our own side of the story by looking at other ones. But to disassociate is really to deny not only around us, other people or cultures or ideas, but it's denying us the richness of seeing another side, even if it may not be our primary opinion. Our opinion can get strengthened or weakened, or it can evolve only really through a dynamic, at least investigation or observation of another side or another viewpoint.
That's a great point. And I think that's where, unfortunately, today you see in a lot of the arguments and in a lot of the conflicts that occur politically and socially and economically, you see this very polarized, dualistic worldview at work. You particularly see it, and this is where the problem is, you particularly see it in the media and these simple-minded depictions of good and bad characters, or these sort of, how can I say this, these talking heads that come on to talk shows. And they basically make points, the most extreme viewpoints on either side. And then they just butt heads for several minutes and get heated and angry. And then the host moves on to another subject. Nothing of value is said on either side for the most part. And generally speaking, it's just, you know, argumentative knee-jerk reactions and propaganda. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because especially today, the world is more complicated, sophisticated, technologically advanced than ever before. It's more dangerous than ever before, even if we think it's not. And we are dumbing ourselves down, I would argue, to these very simple-minded, ideological, dualistic arguments all of the time. And there's a massive amount of information missing, and we're going to get into some of the solutions later on. And there's a massive piece missing from this sort of paradox or this dual sort of battle. And I wanted to get really quickly just into a little bit of the history of kind of how I think we got here. I mean, it's at least in the West. One of the main influences, the early influences on Christianity and Judaism, of course, which our culture is mainly built on Judeo-Christian ideas, and then Greek and Roman ideas and ideals, sort of in a mix. You know, so most of it, our ideas come out of the ancient Near East and the Mediterranean in the West. One of the major influences on both Christianity, Second Temple Judaism, Islam, and probably Buddhism as well, is the ancient Persian religion of Zoroastrianism, which is over 3,000 years old. It was probably founded sometime in around 1000 BCE by Zoroaster, who was an ancient Persian prophet. And it is one of the world's oldest religions still in practice today. It is still in practice today, especially in parts of India and parts of Iran. There are not a lot of Zoroastrians, but they're still around, and that's impressive. Also another main influence of Zoroastrianism was on Gnosticism. So that duality, in Zoroastrianism is really kind of found its way into these religions that were the sort of founding ideas and founding mythologies of Western culture, in essence. Things were built on at least one strain of that foundation. And so the duality in Zoroastrianism plays itself out in a battle between Ahura Mazda and Ahriman, or Angra Mainyu. My ancient Persian is non-existent, so I did my best with that. That's the sort of destructive element. Ahura Mazda is the light god, the creator god. And it, you know, some of the ideas shared by all of the major religions of the West include sort of an idea of heaven and hell, except for Judaism. It really doesn't have that much of that in it. But the idea of heaven and hell, the idea of a sort of eschatological ending of things where there's a battle between good and evil, and good prevails. The idea of this sort of constant battle between good and evil within and without in the world. These are all ideas that were probably brought in through this Zoroastrian influence. So we're going way back, but then, you know, we're going to jump forward to Christianity. Obviously, Christianity eventually took root in Europe, in Rome. Rome's influence spread, Christianity's ideals spread through it, these ideas of duality. In Christianity, it plays out in sort of the idea of God and the devil, God and Satan, and that sort of battle. And then I would, you know, and that sort of theme. Then this leads, as time goes on, Christianity sort of develops new schools of philosophy. You have the Renaissance, sort of a form of humanism, and a sort of neo-pagan, neo-Platonic influence comes into play. Out of that arises the ideas which become the Enlightenment in the 18th century, the Enlightenment. And these were built on ideas generated by Bacon and Descartes. And then those fed into Hume, Voltaire, Rousseau, Diderot, etc. And basically laid the groundwork for a split between science and religion. Science became free to explore as it would in its own domain, and religion was kind of left to do its own thing. And then we find ourselves in this sort of postmodern world now where it's even rejecting the ideas of modernity, and it's definitely questioning the ideas of the objective scientific worldview and so on. And it does it in a way where it basically says, since there are all these different subjective points of view and we are all these autonomous eyes observing objective reality, and we all necessarily taint that by our culture and our gender and our biology and so on, that there is no possible objective truth. And so we're left in this sort of nihilistic state. And that's a problem as well. So that is no solution to the problem. Postmodernism is no solution between the pre-modern argument or the religious argument and the modern argument or the scientific argument. Postmodernism, unfortunately, while well-meaning and certainly has some great ideas to it, I'm not dismissing it, but in its most extreme forms, it becomes very nihilistic and very relativistic, which it says essentially then there's no meaning to anything because there's all meaning and all meaning is equal. You can see the intellectual problem with that when you think about that, because when you say all ideas are equally valid, that is an opinion, that is an idea, and you're preferencing that to other ideas. So there's an illogical problem with that argument. At any rate, we find ourselves today then with this missing piece. So there's this paradox, there's this polarity or duality we find ourselves in: science, religion, good, evil, West versus the East, you know, liberal democracy versus extreme Islam, you know, all of these dichotomies we find ourselves arguing about. And, you know, there's a missing piece to this puzzle. There's a missing piece to this puzzle. So in order to find that missing piece to the puzzle, we're going to go back to ancient philosophy and start with Plato. We'll start with Plato. So one of Plato's main themes in his philosophical stance were the ideas of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And actually, I'm going to hand that off to you to tell us a little bit about the good, the true, and the beautiful. All right. Actually, I'm not going to hand that off to you.
Well, let me just jump in with compliment a point that you were making in this, you know, historical lineage. I think very strong in this modern era, going back to the Renaissance, and you mentioned Descartes, who through the term Cartesian dualism has taken the blame. That he split, you know, mind and body and spirit and matter, and, you know, that it's all his fault. Yes, a term was built around his name. But if you listen to his most famous quote, I think, therefore I am, between thought and being, the consciousness and, you know, physicality, I think, therefore, not I think and completely different subject, I am. It's that they're inextricably linked. But part of the other reason why he took the blame for it is he, being a scientist, as well as a philosopher and a mathematician, he was interested in human physiology and anatomy, and he was unable to do autopsies or really dig into, so to speak, the human body for studies, because that was strictly forbidden by the church at the time. So here it is, right at this split, or right where science is coming into its own, and you know, the more superstitious religion, religious structures aren't able to sustain their idea because science is rising. He's sort of a fulcrum, kind of a midpoint. So what he, I guess what he put forth is that the consciousness that once the body, or the being, I guess, in the body has died, that the body is now a scientific thing. It's not, the soul is gone. So mm-hmm. that was his, that's how he was able to, that was his workaround, literally, for this scientific inquiry. But it became this thing that, well, mind and body are separated. And that's been...
Yeah, and I think I completely agree with you. And that whole idea that Descartes is to blame for all of our sort of modern problems and this problem of duality is really not a fair argument. And in general, you know, the early sort of modernists were much less extreme than today's scientists and those who cling to the sort of scientific materialist worldview, where they claim there is no meaning. Most of the early modernists were not in that camp per se. So, you know, this is something that's taken root, I think, over time. The other thing that's challenging about it is again, like I said, you know, what they were doing, and it was a valuable thing. And Wilbur talks of that as the dignity of modernity, this idea of the differentiation of the different spheres of knowledge. And essentially what happened during that time in the modern time is, you know, the positive things that came out of this differentiation essentially between the ideas of art, religion, and science. So, you know, they became their own separate realms, essentially, whereas before, in the pre-modern mind, everything was kind of glommed together. This differentiation, in turn, created these massive technological breakthroughs in medicine and economics and social structure. It created democracy. Later on, you know, women's rights and feminism came out of that, and sort of... you know, the laws protecting the individual, all these are outgrowths of the modern sort of mindset, out of Enlightenment ideals. And those are all fantastic things. They allow us to investigate things in their own realms. Really, the argument then is like, getting back to it, is kind of what's missing between the duality, the polarized state of you know, this scientific idea on one hand, the religious idea on the other hand. Getting back to Plato's good, the true and the beautiful, the missing thing in that equation in our sense is then the beautiful. So the good would be what I should do. It's the moral, the religious, that realm. The true is the sort of scientific and even sort of philosophical digging into archetypes and first ideas and so on, and the sort of base level of truth that's trying to be established. And then the beautiful, the reconciler between that, would be the sort of aesthetic and philosophical and poetic, the world of art and theater and music is the sort of reconciler between those things. And that's what's missing today. That's one of the things that's missing today. Of course, the polarization is problematic, but the missing factor really is the third element, I would argue. You know, it's the beautiful, quote unquote. And, you know, and then, of course, the problem lies also in that dualistic idea, where it becomes a battle between the true, which would be, quote unquote, science, and the maybe the good, or the religious side of things, the sort of moral and ethical responsibilities we have as human beings. The problem is that science says, well, those things can't really be established. And it's not really science's domain to even try to investigate those things. And that is the challenge. That is why this idea of duality is it's nonsense. There's no battle between them. They're two completely different domains. And that's one of the valuable things that came out of modernity to begin with. So getting into that, then we're going to get into the solution a little bit here. The solution, like I said, in my mind, is to find that third way. It's that middle way. It's the middle way. So I'm going to give some examples of some of these in mythology. So there's the idea of Brahma, the creator. That would be, I guess, the good, more or less. Shiva, which is the destroyer. That's kind of the true. That's the sort of harsh reality of life. And then Vishnu is the reconciler between those two, the sort of preserver, as it were. So what we're missing is the reconciler. We're missing the preserver in our argument, in our duality. And that's the mindset we need to find ourselves in. I mean, and that's what Buddha was talking about when he spoke of the middle way. Neither a hedonistic lifestyle, nor a truly ascetic and, kind of painful existence, based on mortification and just rejection of the world entirely, but a middle way, a disciplined middle way. And that's what I'm talking about. That's the preserver. That's the reconciler, that middle way. So in alchemy, you've got sulfur, salt, and mercury. Mercury is the reconciler between sulfur, which is fire, and salt, which is more or less matter, or it's congealed matter. And then mercury, quicksilver, is that sort of element between the two of those. In modern philosophy, of course, you have Hegel, you have the idea of the thesis, the antithesis, and then the synthesis between those two. So that's where we've got to find ourselves. The solution lies in the synthesis. So I'm gonna hand it over to you to talk on that a little bit, because I'm gonna look for a couple of good quotes that I have. So please feel free to talk about the synthesis a little bit. I know you have some good ideas in that area.
Oh, sure. Okay, thanks. And a great way of describing that. I like that from Plato, the way you I'm familiar a little bit with the concept, but the way you contextualize it with our topic today, that we are missing the beautiful. And with conflict between, the
good and the true,
the good and the true, or the guy with the white hat or the black hat, or, my team versus your team. That's where the beautiful gets lost, is in the conflict. So just by virtue of having these two pitted next to each other in that way, the beautiful doesn't really have much room to enter. But even if it's a sporting match, and you step back a little bit, okay, so the Boston Red Sox don't like the New York Yankees or something. That's a rivalry. I'm not really into baseball, but it's one that's in the common, at least the Western mindset. But they both love baseball. Okay, they both love baseball so much, and they both love their home team. It's just a different home team, and they wear a different uniform, and that's really the more contrived aspect of it. But the joy, the beautiful, is the love of baseball and support for one's home team. So. But it's hard to meet on that ground if you are having a World Series or something. You want your team to win, especially if you're betting money on it or something. I mean, it's very important, or you have civic pride in bringing home the trophy. And also you're talking about the Trinity with Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. And I've also heard those described as the creator, the enjoyer, and the destroyer of life, that not only to sustain the life and reconcile them, but that's where the enjoyment comes in, between this creation and destruction. And the destruction obviously is a transformative destruction that leads towards new growth, new birth, new life, but to enjoy it in between. And I think the joy gets lost in all these conflicts, taking sides over something. And in Taoism, when we think of the middle way, or in Buddhism, that this neither left or right, and it's not also some sort of mushed in between, like middle of the road music, that, well, it's not too hard, well, it's not too fast, it's not too loud, well, it's not too mellow either. And then you just have this, it's not very exciting, it's not very enjoyable if it's all watered down and mushed in the middle. So when we're talking about the middle, I like to think of it in a little more dynamic terms instead of being that it's just, you just kind of have this, you know, if you have black and white, that you come together and you just have this, you know, mushy gray, or you have fire and ice and you wind up with lukewarm water, because that's not very appealing. But what you have is a dynamic interplay that it might move more towards this extreme, but not staying there. And then it comes back, one yields to the next, like, again, the day and night cycle, that one becomes the other becomes the one. And that's how they are connected. And it's what you do in between, that's where you can find value. And then you're not subjected to extreme emotion, because that's really how it plays in us. We're so opinionated, or then we defend our side, then we resist the other side, and we forget the old adage, what you resist persists. So by participating in this conflict, you're actually you're perpetuating it. You're making it stronger and moving further away from
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it. And it reminded me, when you were talking about that, of, you know, when Joseph Campbell, you know, talked about saying yes to life, you know, people would ask him, well, how, you know, with all these opposites and all these different battles and so on, can one find a place in life? And, you know, he would say, well, I mean, you have to jump in and participate. The real issue, though, is in the mindset and the intentionality and spiritual sort of focus one brings to a situation. I think I'm reminded of the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna is talking to Krishna, and, you know, Arjuna does not want to go into battle because it's against some of his relatives, but it's his duty to do, quote unquote, the right thing to go into this battle. So, you know, what Krishna tells him is you're in the game. You do what you have to do. You participate in those battles at times, but you're above them in some way. You're not attached to the outcome, and you're trying to do the right thing according to the sort of structure and balance of the universe. And you let go of the attachment to the outcome, and you allow, you know, the universe to kind of flow through you as you do those things. And that's a kind of a reconciliation as well. You know, it reminds me also of the idea in and they talk a lot about holding the opposites. So there's opposites, obviously, at work in everything. These things are real. It's not that they don't exist. And I like how you framed it. Like, we don't want lukewarm water. We don't want a shade of gray all over the world. There are opposites, obviously. There are males and females. There is, you know, there is light and dark. There is night and day. There is, you know, winter and summer. These things are real. It's not that they don't exist. It's that we have to find a place where we don't over-identify with one or the other, and we find a balance point between the two. And I think that's what, like, the scales of justice signify. We're holding up the scales. They're balanced. Sure, they're going to tip down. Sure, they're going to tip up. But eventually, you know, they find some sort of equilibrium. There's an equilibration between the two. You know, in the Greek aesthetic art ideals, there's Apollo, the rational sort of godlike figure of light and rationality and order. And then there's Dionysus, this wild, crazy, orgiastic, poetic sort of, you know, in our modern world, maybe like a Jim Morrison type energy. And the reconciler between those two is Hermes, the communicator, you know, the observer, the analyst, the magician. That's the reconciler between those two things. And that's that triangle again. You know, there's a triangle. You know, so you have the opposites. And the apex of the triangle then is the tension between those two opposites. It's the equilibrium between those two opposites. So it's not that the opposites don't exist, and it's not that you don't maybe weight to one side or the other in one way or the other, but it's that you find a place where you find balance and equilibrium between the two. And like I said, in Jungian terms, that would be holding the opposites. So an example of holding the opposites might be, say, well, you know, I need to live and I need to make a living, and, you know, I don't particularly like my job, but I go anyway, and, you know, I provide for my family and so on. But holding that tension, Then I also find a place for music and art in my life. I carve out a little space where I can do my hobbies and things that I enjoy, and I balance those things out. And while I'm at work, maybe I have an attitude where I try to stay, you know, playful and positive in my mindset and so on. And that's holding that tension. Like, I don't necessarily want to be there, but I am there, and it's my duty, and my family needs that. You know, and that's holding the tension in a way that's not holding tension like, but it's holding the tension, you know, you're in the middle, right? So, you know, do you have anything to add or anything you'd like to talk about in terms of that?
Yeah. That's very well put. And that, you know, in the idea of developing a solution, if we're embroiled in this, you know, left to right or, you know, either or conflict, you miss the apex. You miss that upper part of the triangle because you're so enmeshed in this way. But the interesting thing about a triangle, if both sides would look a little more towards the apex instead of at each other, and they continue to rise, at some point they're going to connect in this center that where both can be held. And if we are holding them both, we are in some other, we're not either here or there. We're somewhere else. We're some, just enough of a space, enough distance that we can maybe look at what's going on. If you're in it, you can't see what's going on. If you're back from it a little bit and a little bit removed, then you're not quite as involved. And this we do with our consciousness, you know. And, you know, first of all, we have to realize that there is this interplay of opposites. But psychologically, you know, where this has really its danger is that we see ourselves as being, you know, here or not here. Like you're saying, talking about a job. Well, if it's our weight or our finance or our career, we could say, gosh, you know, I don't want to be where I am. I want to be at this other level, or even with our health. I want to be at this different place. And if you're too much in fantasy of where you want to be, oh, the riches, and oh, I'm going to have a big bank account and all that, you're kind of denying where you are, and you might be missing on some of the steps that you need to get there. On the opposite, if you're so embroiled with where you are, your weight or your education or whatever, your relationship status, here it is again, always a bridesmaid, or I'm always single, or just, you know, table for one. If you're overly identified with that either, you're missing out on the goal. So if you're holding them both, where I am and where I want to be, there's some real truth to both of them. You're not stuck in fantasy land, and you're not embroiled so much in where things are now that you're unable to, you know, not only move forward, but just to even see the road ahead. So you get some clarity and some perspective that you can't get if you're so embroiled in participating in this this duel.
That's fantastic. That's a great point. I appreciate you bringing that up like that, because I didn't think of it specifically that way. Thank you. So you've been listening to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano. I'm the author of If You Can Worry, You Can Meditate. And Chris Sheridan is the co-host, and he is the author of The Spirit and the Sky. And we have been speaking about the reconciliation of the opposites today. And so I guess our final maybe thought on this concept, unless Chris has something to add, might be to say, find that balance point between the opposites, find that middle ground where you can hold both and hold to both authentically and give them their integrity and their differentiation. But don't allow those two sides to polarize you and dissociate you from reality. And that's where we find the third way, or the middle way, or the reconciler between this and that, or good and evil, or right and wrong, or male and female, or, you know, these gender issues and so on. We've got to find this sort of middle ground where we can connect. And I loved your metaphor for the triangle, you know, between these sort of polarized opposites. Maybe there's a higher sort of third solution if you allow yourself to get into that mindset. So, you know, balance between those opposites, reconcile those opposites. Thank you for listening. We're here every Sunday with a new show, and we appreciate your support. And again, please support us at anchor.fm/cosmiceye, and click on support, and you can support us through there. Go ahead and follow us on YouTube, on iTunes, wherever you're listening to us. And thank you again for showing up. Thank you, Chris, for being here. You had some great points today. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. Always another enjoyable show with you.
It's always a pleasure. Have a great week. Goodbye and God bless.